Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 9 of Homers at the Bat. Today's date is April 7th, 2015. My name is Jeff Crisco. I'm here with Joe Gruen.
Howdy.
Joe, how's it going?
It's going well, man. How about you?
I'm doing pretty great. Did you get a chance to watch a lot of baseball yesterday? I know that was your plan.
That was the initial plan, but I ended up having to go to school, and I missed a few classes recently, so I couldn't take the day off, which I usually do.
You know what I say? School ruins everything.
So true. It ruins your life, kids. That should be the lesson.
Don't go to school. I wanted to take yesterday off, and I wanted to watch the game on Sunday, but Sunday I was driving back from Easter, which is like Passover, but for Christians. I don't know if you know
about that. I do know about Easter, yes.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
Some large rabbit or something.
Yeah. So what happens is Jesus turns into a rabbit and then brings us eggs. But the eggs are chocolate, and nobody's quite sure where the chocolate eggs came from, like if they were like giant chocolate chickens or something.
But is this anyways, true? Really? I mean, I know it's like symbolic to a certain extent of spring.
Well, no, because in the Bible, Jesus is like, "And I turned my flesh into chocolate eggs, and you eat the chocolate eggs and marshmallow peeps."
Oh, well, I'm Jewish, so I don't know.
Yeah,
any...
I don't expect you to know. Well, you know,
very, very technical.
Yeah, it's very religious. Anyways, but the long and short of it was I only got to watch the Giants game yesterday, so I was pretty disappointed that I missed most of opening day yesterday, and it sounds like you did too. So
yeah, I tuned into the Detroit Minnesota game, but. That was about it. And then I got I caught the last four innings of the Giants game.
Oh, so you got to see. So the Giants won yesterday 5-4. It really shouldn't have been that close. It was pretty much a disastrous eighth inning that made it that close. So you saw me. You see Sergio Romo?
Yeah, I did get a chance to see Sergio Romo. I missed the Javi Lopez Machi thing. I mean, I blinked and it was a 5-4 game.
Or
a
5-1.
Well, it was 5-1, and then I saw the Romo double that made
The Romo blow up. Yeah, Lopez and Machi just, you know, they let guys get on, and then Romo was like, "Oh, don't worry, guys. I'll take care of that for you." He just left a meatball that Jake Lamb just blasted. And that should have been a grand slam, honestly.
Yeah, it should have tied the game. And we had kind of touched on that in our last podcast, how Romo tends to hang his slider. I mean, it's really interesting. We were just talking about this, and then sure enough, he throws this, you know, low 80s slider that doesn't slide right around the belt, and bam, just almost took it out of the ballpark.
Yeah, it was at that pitch, because anybody who asked, I was like, Romo's going to take the job back from Casilla. Romo's going to take the job back from Casilla. And then when I saw him hang that pitch, I was like, oh, no, maybe I'm wrong. it was ugly. And then Casilla was throwing the fire in the ninth. And what's funny was I do the news updates, you know, for Fantasy Pros. Mm-hmm. I wrote up the Santiago Casilla one after the second out, and I was like, he got a pop out, which he did, ground out, which he did, and I was like, oh, I'll just put this in there just in case it happens, and a strikeout of Paul Goldschmidt. And then I sat there and I was like, huh, I guess I predicted the future, and then I submitted it.
Yeah.
So he
looked pretty good.
Yeah, Casilla looked his stuff looked on point last night, and Romo just looked lost. It was like everybody in the bullpen but Santiago Casilla and Jeremy Affelt looked pretty bad.
Yeah, but it must have maybe that's what gave Casilla the confidence to go out there and just dominate was the fact that he knew that nobody was even close to touching his job after that.
Yeah, he didn't have to worry about anybody coming up behind him. You know, he wasn't like, oh, you know, if I hang a pitch, you know, everybody else is doing so well. Right. Everybody else was pretty much garbage. So, but the Giants won. Madison Bumgarner looked mostly good. Since he missed a lot of the game, he was having some control issues, and that was kind of concerning to me. Really? A couple times Buster lined up. or set up, and the ball was nowhere near where the target was supposed to be. It was very un-mad bum. And then he also plunked two guys, which I texted you because I thought you were watching. I was like, hey, can Mad Bum stop plunking people? Because he hit two guys in the first, I think, three innings. And I was like, oh, goodness, this is like the arm issue and all that stuff. And
yeah.
But he locked it down. He only had a few strikeouts, but he looked really good.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty odd. I caught a little bit of Bumgarner. I mean, I caught the last two innings he pitched. And I honestly thought he was going to go the rest of the game because those plunks came early in the game. Mm-hmm. And really after like the first second, from what I was able to tell, he been and was pitching fairly well. And he when he got pulled, he'd only thrown 93 pitches, and 62 of them were strikes, which is pretty typical Mad Bum.
Yeah.
So it just the move just like reeked of kind of trying to preserve a guy that pitched a lot in the postseason and preserve him for the rest of the season. It just seemed like a weird panic move where it didn't need to be a panic move.
What do you mean a panic move?
The Bochy pulling him after seven innings. I mean, 93 pitches is not that much for a pitcher of his caliber. He's not some guy coming off of surgery or a rookie just making his first start in the league. It just seemed like way too early to pull a guy when he could have gone at least another inning, if not the whole game.
Oh, see, that's where I disagree. I think it was kind of unnecessary. When Boch pulled him, it was 5-1. He wasn't going for a shutout or anything like that. I mean, if it was 5-0, I'm sure Boch would have left him in there. But
right.
I think it was just sort of, all right, you did good, kid. Let's get it to the bullpen. Let's get out of here sort of deal. I don't think he was like, oh, my God, we need to get him out there. Because he wasn't, like, out there, like, visiting the mound a bunch of times like you see when it's a worrisome thing.
But I guess that's the other thing. Like, that almost made it weirder was, he didn't put anybody on base. He wasn't really falling apart in the seventh inning. He shut it down pretty quick. And then to have, to bring the bullpen out. And granted, I don't think he could have expected that it would implode like that. But it just seemed like an odd thing. You look around the league on opening day, and so many teams allow their ace to go out and pitch a complete game, even if they've given up a run or if they started off a little shaky. Like, Price almost pitched a full game, and Scherzer almost pitched a full game, and you just see guys go out there and pitch like 8-9 innings consistently on opening day.
I don't know if that's a smart move, though. Just because everybody's doing it, I don't know if that's the best move. I mean, people are still – there's a reason it's called midseason form,
Yeah.
I just don't think the best thing to do is go out there and have him go 8-9 innings, wait for him to fall apart. I had no problem with him pulling Mad Bum.
It seemed I don't know. I guess I don't have a major problem with it, but I was trying to think of something to say. 93 pitches just seemed really low.
Well, we can't abuse him forever. I mean, we talked about how Kane's falling apart, Mets comes falling apart because they were abused. They were ridden too hard, and it was. I see no reason why in game one of 162 you tax Madison Bumgarner's arm.
Well, I definitely see what you're saying. I think that the fact that the Giants have such a weak pitching staff going into this season, it makes every Bumgarner start like a must win. Like, unless he's getting shelled, you gotta win those games. You gotta make sure that you win those games, and I think the best way to do it is to keep Bumgarner in there.
Well, yeah, but if Bumgarner goes 9 innings every game, guess what? Bumgarner's starting 23, 24 games instead of 30 for you. Because he's going to go down at some point. Because his arm is taxed, dude. It's so taxed.
Well, you can always give him an extra day off. Like, you can like throw in an extra starter, like a sixth starter, and just give him like a little bit of space, but I don't know. I mean, the Giants are in a precarious situation this year, and it really – I felt it last night. When that game started to slip away and I thought that there was a good chance that the Giants could lose it in the eighth inning, it just brought back all the kind of fears that I've suppressed going into the season of potential disaster.
I mean, it was a lot of flukiness, and it was really just one pitch. But ultimately, I'm gonna have to disagree with you. I think pulling Matt Baum was the best decision to make there, despite the results of them almost blowing the game. He's just so taxed last year, and I know they have to know that going in. And you're talking about, you know, squeezing a sixth starter, pushing him back a day, all that stuff. And if we want to maximize the starts, you got to go let him pull him, you know, in the sixth, seventh inning sometimes. That's just what I think.
Fair enough. But we almost dropped the game to a team that I think we both agree is one of the five worst teams in baseball.
Yeah, I can say that.
So it just got to me. I don't know. We ended up winning, so I guess it's all for naught. But
yeah. We mentioned all this stuff about overtaxing pitchers, and one guy we talked about in the Giants preview before, Matt Cain. He's gonna miss his start because of forearm tightness. Sounds like he's gonna be out a couple weeks, but forearm tightness can be a UCL tear, which leads to Tommy John surgery. So you mentioned you want to talk a little bit about this. So, Joe, what's up with Matt Cain and his arm?
It looks like it's a flexor tendon strain.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's in the elbow, right?
I'm going to say yes.
In the albular region, somewhere around the elbow. But yes. It doesn't seem to be something that leads to ligament damage, which is good. And it probably means that it's probably what we used to call elbow soreness or tightness, and now we just call it this more technical flexor tendon strain. Which means that he probably shouldn't be out longer than a month at maximum.
I'd say so. When I saw the forearm tightness, I was like, oh no.
Right.
Oh no. I was like, because Matt Cain may have thrown his last pitch if it was a UCL tear.
Right. Right.
All right, so little something else about last night's game. Two Giants made their debuts last night, and Nori Aoki and Casey McGee, and they both looked good. Nori Aoki tried to bunt on the first pitch of the game, the very first pitch of the season, and he tried to bunt. I was like, oh no! I was like, Nori Aoki, what are you doing?
He's trying to flash his speed.
Yeah, he's not that fast.
No, he's not.
But I think they both look good out there. I was kind of impressed how slap-hitty the Giants were put together, and that it seemed pretty useful. I mean, granted, they were knocking around Colemanter, they were knocking around Clayton Kershaw. But he is the ace of the staff by default, so in theory things should get better tonight.
Yeah, you would think that they would be able to go out there and piece some runs. And the other thing that was really encouraging about last night, like while the pitching staff, and by pitching staff, I mean the bullpen, was very discouraging. The fact that Posey and Belt combined 0 for 8 and the Giants still pieced together 5 runs and 13 hits was really encouraging. Because you know that's not going to happen every night.
Yeah, Angel Pagan was awesome setting the table last night. Like you're like, oh yeah, this is the guy that plays for the Giants, you know, 100 games a year. Oh, he's not hurt. I think I've said it before. I don't think I've said it on the podcast that as Angel Pagan goes, the Giants go. I mean, when he goes down, their record just gets destroyed because he's a great table setter for them.
Yeah, and he was kind of setting the table from the middle of the lineup, really.
Yeah, he was number 3 last night. That was what was weird.
Yeah, so they let off Aoki, and then Panic fit in at the number 2 hole, which he's really settled into.
Yeah, he was good too.
It makes you wonder, like, if Aoki keeps hitting 300 and above and getting on base at a high percentage, then is Pagan just going to be the 3-hole hitter? Like, because he's too good of a hitter to bat any lower than 5th, and once Pence comes back, that's going to bump some guys. Like, it really kind of puts the pressure on Belt to piece together a good team, because if he doesn't, then he can find himself batting sixth or seventh.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was trying to think of how I would construct the lineup with Nori Aoki back in it, or still in it once Pence gets back. Luckily, Angel Pagan will probably get hurt before then. We don't have to worry about that.
Right,
but,
fortunately, yeah.
Yeah, fortunately. But, I mean, if Pagan's such a great table setter, and they may want to put him in the one hole and drop Aoki down in the lineup just to extend the quality hitters in the lineup, you know?
Agreed, yeah.
So yeah, that might be a thing. And then Joe Panik, yeah, you mentioned Joe Panik. He had three hits last night. I think I said before he's sort of an empty average guy. I don't know about that. His hits look solid. There wasn't a lot of power behind him, but you know, if he could get a 350 on base percentage, I'd be more than happy with that out of the two hole. You know, with a good number of those being singles, hopefully get Aoki over to third on those singles, and set him up for, I guess we'll call him the Killer Peas. No? Pagan, Posey?
And Panic.
And Pence. And,
oh, Pence, yeah.
And Prandon Crawford and... No, sorry.
Every time I watch him, I'm just so impressed with his pitching, with his batting eye, and his bat speed. Like, it's really... The pitches he's able to get to and foul off are impressive, and his eye for pitches near the zone but not quite is really impressive. And just the fact that, you know, he just doesn't hit for power, it amazes me, because he looks like he should be able to get good pitches that he can hit pretty far.
Yeah, and that was something that I don't know why I'd never noticed it really before, but Panik, yeah, his bat speed was really impressing me last night. It was sort of the one thing that stuck out to me was it always seemed like the ones that I thought he was going to be fouling off, those were the ones he was getting for hits because his bat speed just sort of made up for, I don't want to call it like late decision making, but it looked like all of his swings to me looked a half second late, but because of his bat speed, it worked out for him.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was a little late on some pitches. It was just I don't know if it's just because, like, I know he plays second base and the way he looked, but he looked a lot like Chase Utley at the plate. Like, I was just really, like, I got this weird flashback of watching Chase for the Phillies while watching Panik. But, you know, I just, obviously he doesn't have the power. I've looked through his minor league numbers and it's just not there. He's never hit over seven in the minors, so he's never going to hit for power. But, you know, if he can hit for average consistently, then he can be their everyday number two hitter.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what you want out of a number two hitter. You don't want him to strike out. He doesn't need to hit. You know, he doesn't need to be an all or nothing guy, because if it goes for nothing, then, you know, you're not setting up your number three hitter for success. And number two is who can put the bat on the ball and just have a decent OBP is
and exactly not hit into double plays.
Yeah, and hit it scorchers. Don't just hit rollers to shortstop.
Right.
So.
And he looks like he can do that. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I was impressed by Joe Panik a lot last night. So we talked about Nori Aoki, but another Giant made his debut last night, and I realized something about Casey McGee. I want to ask you about this. It's I was looking at him, and does Casey McGee look more like fat Fred Durst or a baby with a goatee?
You know, I realized something when you brought up Casey McGee just now, and that's that I don't know much about Casey McGee. I kind of know what he looks like. Yeah, he looks kind of fat.
He looks like...
His beard looks trashy, so I guess fat Fred Durst. That's what I'll get.
Yeah, he looks like... Oh, his picture on Google doesn't do it justice. On the game tonight, take a look at it with that question in mind. I was like, he looks like a baby with a goatee, and I was like, no, he looks kind of like a fat Fred Durst, but...
yeah, it could be. You know... Regardless of what he looks like, he went out and went 2-for-3 in his first game as a Giant and walked in another plate appearance. So he looked great last night, and that's certainly relieved Giants fans who were maybe concerned that we would get empty production from third base.
Yeah, I mean, I went as far as to say it, that we're going to get no production from third base, but I mean, you had to at least expect that, because I'm looking at his stats now. Before he went to Japan in 2013, his OBP was 284 in 2012, which is bad, 280 in 2011, which is even worse, and that's sort of been a cratering from his prior year, which was 337 and 360. And then last year he bumped it back up to a 350, a respectable 350. But what I was worried about with him is his OBP was 355 last season, and his slugging was 357. So he's going to be a lot like Panic, I think, where he's not getting a lot of power. But, you know, if you put the bat on the ball, getting hits and walks is better than getting out. So
this is true. I realized, looking at his stats, that he only hit 300 one year, and it was barely. He hit 301 in 2009. And his OBP was only 360 to go along with that year. So not, like, a great leap in OBP.
Yeah, and that was arguably his best year all around, was in 2009, because it was his highest OPS by far, unless you count 2015, one-game sample size, 1.4 OPS, I liked what I saw about him. Same thing you said, he had a good eye at the plate. I wonder if he fixed something that was wrong with him when he was over in Japan.
Those Japanese players know how to hit. They have good eyes, so maybe some batting coach over in Japan got to him and taught him some tricks.
Yeah, did that thing like the in the NFL, there's the quarterback whisperers who's like, oh no, you just need to fix this one thing about your mechanics. And maybe somebody in Japan saw the same thing about McGee and fixed it. But either way, I was pretty happy with what I saw.
Yeah, you couldn't not be happy. I didn't get a chance to see any of his defense, though. But I'm not seeing any errors, and I am seeing two double plays, so one of which McGee was involved in. So
he got bailed out by Brandon Crawford on one. He biffed a ball pretty bad, but Crawford saved it from, because he booted it into shallow right, but Crawford was running after him to back it up and got the ball. So I think it got charged as a hit, because it was going to be a tough play. But other than that, he played pretty well. That one was ugly though.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of time, and I'm sure you know. Something's going to happen, and again, the Diamondbacks are not the greatest gauge for some of this stuff, so we're going to have to find out more maybe in a couple weeks when they start playing some real teams.
Some non-tomato cans. So.
Right.
So, alrighty. So, I think that's pretty much everything that I wanted to talk about the Giants game last night. Was there anything left that you wanted to talk about with the Giants game last night?
Not necessarily with the game, but I would like to go back to the Matt Cain injury, because seeing that as he's out for a period of time, we are going to call up our first, for us, you know, Giants fans, mega prospect, I guess, pitcher that we've had floating around the minors for a while now, and that's Chris Heston, who is 26 years old and has spent 2 years in AAA. And last year pieced together a pretty nice year. He doesn't throw for a lot of strikeouts, and his strikeout to walk is a little questionable. But 173 innings pitched with a 3.38 ERA, 125 strikeouts, so that is low, to 51 walks, which is a little scary, and 16 home runs, which is also really scary. But 1.17 WHIP, so not too bad. What do you think? What do you think about Chris Heston? Do you know anything about him?
Well, I saw one of his. Here's everything I know about Chris Heston. I saw one of his starts during spring training, and he looked good.
Yeah.
That's all I got. That's all I got for Chris Heston. I'm excited to see him come up. I really liked what I saw. In that one start, I'm a little bit worried that he's coming up so soon. I thought he needed a little bit more seasoning. There's nothing in particular that made me think that. It's just that feeling that you get, you know, that this guy's going to be good. And I just really hope that he hits the ground running, best case scenario, and worst case scenario, it doesn't stunt his development by, you know, just tossing him out there.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I was kind of hoping that they would go ahead and give Yusmeiro Petit another chance at being a starter since he was so good for them last year as a fill-in starter. But I can't argue with them turning to a guy like Chris Heston. That gives me hope that maybe we are developing worthwhile pitchers and minor league players.
Yeah, having that guy in the minors is really good. And I'm wondering if they're holding on to Petit to see what happens with Peavy's injury, because, you know, he's he's getting his start pushed back, and yeah. Vogelsong starting in his place. So I'm wondering, since Petit's much more useful as a long relief guy, that they could lean on him in different situations and have Heston go tomorrow. I'm wondering if they're using Petit as Vogelsong insurance for tonight.
Maybe, or just Vogelsong, Lincecum, Tim Hudson, you know, name a starter insurance.
Yeah, right? Just sort of, that's what he was, I mean, that's what he did last year. He came in and did some spot starts, and he was really good in those. And so maybe they're set to keep him in that role and, you know, keep his flexibility open.
Yeah, and I guess if there's ever a time to bring up a pitcher, a young, you know, minor league pitcher, it would be either later in the season when you have absolutely no shot, or this at the very, very beginning of the season where it can't hurt you too much if he goes out and bombs a couple starts.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see Heston start. I'm looking here. It looks like he's going to start tomorrow. So I'll have to pencil in watching that game. Not like I wasn't already going to watch it, but I'll make sure that I do it, because I want to see what he does against real competition, not just spring training.
Yeah, it should be fun to watch.
Should be fun. So, speaking of should be fun, Joe.
Yes.
I want to run down a team. It's a mystery team. What they did in their first game. All their starters. Are you ready for it?
I am.
All right. The leadoff man, 0 for 4. The number 2 guy, 0 for 4. Number 3 hitter, 0 for 3. Cleanup man, 0 for 3. Number 5 hole, 0 for 3. Number 6, 1 for 3. Number 7, 1 for 3. Number 8, 1 for 3. And then the pitcher slot. Joe, do you know what team this was?
I do, but only because I know the pitcher that went against them. And I believe it was Sonny Gray, and I believe that's the Texas Rangers.
Wrong.
Oh, really?
It's our favorite team, the Philadelphia Phillies.
Oh, wow.
The worst team in baseball. I saw that line, and I was like, yep, we got to talk about that. Just as a quick aside, Cody Ashe was the number 4 hitter. Ryan Howard was the number 6 hitter. So that Freddie Galvis was number 5. So that makes you sort of scratch your head a little bit and makes you wonder. That was just a quick aside I wanted to tell you, see if you knew about how the worst team in baseball fared in the first game.
Yes, yeah, they are the worst team in baseball. I am kind of know about that, but part of the reason I don't necessarily, I mean, obviously a lot of that has to do with the Phillies being bad, but I think that there is some hope with Clay Buchholz and maybe him being the one guy in that pitching staff who can piece it together this season. So he went out and he pitched a gem, obviously, went 7 innings, 9 strikeouts, and I believe only gave up 2 or 3 hits or something like that.
Wait, you said Clay Buchholz. Do you mean Cole Hamels?
No, I mean Clay Buchholz. Cole Hamels pitches for the Phillies.
Oh, your transition really confused me because I thought you were talking about a bright spot for the Phillies. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to edit that out. So 3.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, no, I just meant that I don't think it was all the Phillies being terrible as much as it was maybe some signs that the Red Sox might have a real pitcher in that bummed out pitching staff.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. I think that you're right. There may be a glimmer of hope there. I know the big issue going into the season was that pitching staff. Obviously, that offense can rake, and Buchholz was obviously set to be their staff ace. He started the first game, and he was impressive. He granted the Phillies lineup isn't the best, but he didn't go out there and embarrass himself like Kyle Loesch did, giving up 10 runs to the Rockies. But I thought it was an impressive line from Buchholz, and maybe they can hang on to that Rosny Castillo and hang on to Mookie Betts and not trade them for a pitching asset like we talked about that they should do. Because they did also extend Rick Porcello to a 4-year extension? Yeah, they gave him big money. They gave him $20 million a year for 4 years.
$20 million a year?
For Rick Porcello, yeah.
Oh, my God. What is happening to baseball where that's a possibility?
Yeah, it's insane, but obviously they like what they see with Porcello, so they can they'll have a 1-2 going for them, and maybe they don't need to go out and get a Cole Hamels type, and they can hang on to their young guys. So that's good. That's good for the Red Sox.
That is good for them.
That's a team that's going to go far this season if they can keep getting performances like that from Buchholz and lots of runs from the offense like they had yesterday.
I would also like to check the board, and if you could, on our imaginary board, could you just put one tally under Nolan Arenado's name as he hits the 30 home run mark?
Luckily, all right, so mentally I've done that. He has one, and he needs a lot more than that, but he's off to a good start.
He won't see Kyle Loesch every day, as they say.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He's not going to be seeing Kyle Loesch, Mr. Dingers, every day. But he did get off to a good start. He and Tulo were pretty impressive yesterday. I didn't get to see a lot of the game. I just scanned a lot of box scores. And the Rockies certainly filled it up. And
did.
Kyle Kendrick did a lot to not embarrass himself like everybody thought he would.
Yeah. I mean, I can't say that I think he's going to keep it up all year, but... You know, good for him for going out there and not giving away a 10-run lead.
And really, that's all you can ask of from Kyle Kendrick is, hey, we spotted you double digits. Please don't blow this for us.
Right. So I also, another guy I was impressed with yesterday, Ben Zobrist, I thought really did well to step in and prove that he deserved the contract he got from Oakland. And being able to bat in that three-hole and really being the centerpiece of their offense. He went out, hit 2-for-5, one home run with 2 RBI.
Yeah, he was good. He got his home run, like, very early in the game because I was watching the game and I was doing stuff. And I had Twitter open, and all of a sudden it was, like, a million tweets came in, and it was the Ben Zobrist home run. And people were... I mean, the big question, everybody's like, well, where is the A's going to get runs? So everybody was like, yeah, why don't you shove that where the A's going to get runs? The A's are going to get runs from Ben freaking Zobrist. And,
right. And not only Ben Zobrist. I mean, they went out and scored 8 runs and blanked the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, Sonny Gray almost had a no-hitter. I feel as though I contributed to it being broken up because my mom's a big A's fan, and I texted her, said, hey, are you watching the A's game? She said, no. I said, Gray has a no-hitter, and she turned it on, and then they got a hit. So
excellent.
That is all my fault, so you're welcome. All A's fans out there, I'm sorry I broke up the no-hitter.
Anything to think about the Dustin Pedroia 2 home runs? I mean, he was kind of really struggling and kind of declining, one would almost say, over the course of the last at least season. I mean, last season was a down year for him. He only hit 7 home runs, 278. And the year before, he hit 301, but he only had 9 home runs, which was a major drop-off from 15. So what do you think about him going out and clubbing 2 home runs in his first start? Off Cole Hamels, no less.
So this is actually something I've been thinking a lot about because I've been a big guy of saying to avoid Dustin Pedroia in fantasy drafts. Mm-hmm. This year because everybody's like, well, you know, he had his hand injury and his wrist injury, and, you know, that's all better, and, you know, he'll go out there and hit home runs. And my point was his isolated slugging percentage has been dropping every single year, his ISO. Even before the hand and wrist injuries, it's been steadily declining. So I was saying, you know, maybe Dustin Pedroia, I mean, he'll score a lot of runs and have a lot of RBI just as a product of the lineup. But I was saying, if you're depending on him for stolen bases, he's getting old. If you're depending on him for runs, his ISO has been going down every single season. So I ended up with a little egg on my face. We'll see how that goes. But I don't see him hitting two bombs, you know, very frequently.
Do you think he is a lock, though, for double-digit home runs?
Well, I mean, he's got 161 games to hit eight. So at this point, yeah, it's kind of a shoo-in for him to get double-digit home runs just because he got off to such a good start.
Yeah, I mean, I had listened to a lot of fantasy guys, and, you know, I eventually broke down and I drafted a team. I don't know
if I know
that on this podcast, but I've drafted one team, and so while I was listening to these fantasy pundits, a lot of them were just bagging on Dustin Pedroia. I mean, that he was like the you know, punch, you know, like the beat up doll or whatever.
The whipping boy.
I don't know the term. Yeah, yeah. He's the punching bag of the fantasy community. And I could understand why when I went back and I looked at his stats, but it just seemed a little too early for him to be falling off the face of the map. So I was kind of impressed to see him go out and hit two solo home runs. And in that offense, if he can piece together any kind of serviceable season, it's going to be a really nice year for him.
Yeah. Like I said, I knew he was going to produce just as a product of the lineup. He was just one guy that I was very happy to be wrong on, mostly because now we're delving into fantasy. I was much happier with the price point on a Colton Wong even a Howie Kendrick, because you could get them rounds and rounds later, because Pedroia still has that name value, sort of buoys, you know, where he goes in drafts. So,
right.
I want everybody to do well. Obviously, that can't happen in baseball. Everybody can't do well, but, you know, if Pedroia reclaims something, good for him. And I was actually listening to the Fantasy Focus baseball podcast today while I was driving around for work, and they have Stefani Bell on, ESPN's injury expert, and she said that his surgery last season, and I didn't know this detail about his surgery, it wasn't like an invasive surgery, like they had to go in and fix anything or, you know, clean up bone spurs or anything like that. What it was there was some irritation from basically something was just out of place, and it was rubbing and causing him extreme pain, and when they went in and fixed it, it basically fixed him immediately. He had to recover from that. So you know, with knowing that detail, maybe I was leading the wrong hype train, but yeah, we'll see. I think he's a lock to double-digit home runs now, just because he's got, like I said, 161 games to hit eight, so that he'll get to 10.
Agreed. Moving on to somebody who does not play for Boston, but instead plays for another big market. And a team that I was very high on coming into the season, and I'm pretty proud to say they did well yesterday against, I think, the team that we think is the best in baseball. Bartolo Colon pitching for the New York Mets, six innings strong, one win, obviously.
only one? <K's,
laughs> and I believe he gave up only one run.
Yeah, Bartolo Colon was impressed yesterday. You got to, you know, I'm going to throw some cold water on it. It was the Washington Nationals, but it was not the Washington Nationals. There are a lot of guys who are hurt. But he outdueled Matt Scherzer. So,
yeah.
I just called Max Scherzer.
So where do you stand on Bartolo Colon? Because he's kind of an interesting guy to try to dissect. For the last, let's see, 6 seasons, he's kind of been a guy who's been good, and then he'll post a disaster year, and then he'll post two good years, and then another not-so-great year. What do you think Bartolo Colon can do this year?
I mean, ultimately, I think Colon is sort of just a guy. He's in the he's a good, not great number two, great number three. He doesn't do anything very electric to make you get really excited. I'm looking at this. He somehow had 8 strikeouts yesterday, when in the past he seemed to be very much a pitch-to-contact hitter. So not having seen the game, I don't know if it was some impatience on the Nationals' part. Some guys think it may be since they are bereft of so much talent right now on the DL that they had to make something happen, so they're swinging and missing more. Because I doubt at, you know, in his, let's see, he started in 97, so I doubt in 2015 he changed something about his repertoire or added another pitch. I don't know. He's just a guy. He's still chugging along. He's a big fat fatty, but it works for him. And he may have found something in Oakland that sort of fixed him, like we're talking about Casey McGahee, because it looks like he posted a 4 ERA last year, but before that...
265, right?
Yeah, 265 and 343 for Oakland. So I like him. He's unspectacular. He's a pitch-to-contact guy. Lots of ground balls, you know.
He's 42, too. But
yeah, he's an old man.
I would like to mention that the Washington Nationals, the team that we both think is the best in baseball, marched out Dan Uggla yesterday. So that could account for at least a few of those strikeouts, right?
Dan Uggla. There it is. There's the answer. Oh, you know what? I knew that because there was a – here's a good trivia question for you. Who was the most expensive player on the Braves payroll yesterday?
Is it Dan Uggla?
It's Dan Uggla.
Holy cow.
Because they cut him, they're still paying him. So he is the most expensive player on the Braves payroll, and he's the starting second baseman for the Washington.
But I thought they had Craig Kimbrell, Jeff.
But no, Joe, they traded Craig Kimbrell. Nice segue. They traded Craig Kimbrell and Melvin Upton for a load of players. I wasn't ready for that, so I have to pull that up.
I will fill in. He was traded, Craig Kimbrell, as well as B.J. Upton, to the San Diego Padres, who decided, I guess, that they just didn't make enough moves in the offseason to solidify a spot at the top of the NL West.
Yeah, it was right before Sunday Night Baseball started, I remember, because I got the alert, and I was like, what the heck? And I was just flabbergasted when I saw it that Kimbrell and Upton were going to the Padres, and it was just astonishing. I just sort of sat. I got the alert. I just sort of stood there, staring at my phone, just going, "What the like you said, like did the Padres not make enough moves in the off season? They're like, oh, we need to squeeze one more in before the first game of the season." But here's my thing about this trade. What did you see the Padres and Dodgers doing before this trade? You saw the Padres getting a wild card. You saw the Dodgers winning the division. Does this change so much about the Padres that you now see them winning the division?
Not really. I think that I already really liked the Padres' bullpen. Now, I know they didn't do too well yesterday. They gave up a win to the Dodgers, who are in their own rights a very good team. But I think it does give the Padres some flexibility if Will Myers were to not work out and Matt Kemp were to not work out, then they have, you know, Melvin Upton, who obviously could also not work out, but at least they have another guy that could step in and potentially fill a hole for them so that they're not left completely screwed. The Craig Kimbrell thing, I mean, in my opinion, Craig Kimbrell is one of the top three best relievers in baseball. So to pull him in as your closer and bring him to a park like Petco, it obviously strengthens an already strong bullpen. So I think, you know, I know their bullpen struggled yesterday, but that was really the only element of their team that struggled. So, well, outside of course, Will Middlebrooks, but I really like the move. I think that it puts them in a position where they could win the division potentially.
Oh, wow. See, the thing is, it didn't change much about the division for me because I had the Dodgers as such prohibitive favorites that this, even if this tacks on two, three extra wins, it doesn't really change how the standings are going to go for me. I think what it does for them is it does sort of in the wild card play-in game and in short division series, it gives them a really solid end of rotation where if you're blanking out, say, 2 innings right at the end, because Benoit's really good, and then you have Kimbrel coming in, that's just it essentially becomes a 7-inning game. If the Padres are ahead at that point, it's over. So I think it does well for them for the wild card game and for the playoffs. But in the long course of the season, I don't see a talent jump from Benoit to Kimbrel in the ninth really changing that much for them over 162.
So I really like a guy that they don't have in their bullpen, even though I think that he's going to end up coming back up, and that's Kevin Quackenbush, and I believe I touched on him
Yeah.
in the last podcast. I think with Quackenbush, Benoit, and Kimbrel at the end of their bullpen, it gives those starters a lot of flexibility to fail, which is what you need when you have a staff that's as young as the Padres have with Tyson Ross and Cashner and Kennedy. It's a good thing to have because you can always bring those guys in after maybe six innings as opposed to having to bring in your bullpen a little earlier and expect some shutdown innings.
Yeah, that's what I was sort of saying. Yeah, you could just sort of write off those innings as being, most of the time, no runs, and that helps you maybe stick with your young guys a little longer, like you said, knowing that even if they falter a little bit, the guys at the end of the bullpen aren't gonna screw it up for you. So.
Yeah.
I like the trade for the Padres. It's depth on depth, which we both preach depth as the reason for success, and it'll do a lot for them to secure a wild card berth. But like I said before, I don't see it changing how the division plays out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying it's 100% going to change the division, but I like them all the more. I already thought that they were a potential playoff team, and now I almost think it's a foregone conclusion.
It's a lock. Yeah, I think it's a lock that two wild card teams are coming from the NL West this year. I mean, obviously, barring some sort of catastrophic Clayton Kershaw injury or something like that.
Which, of course, we're not hoping for. We're not monsters.
No, I didn't, pray and wish for a Clayton Kershaw injury last night or anything like that. Not at all.
Not at all.
Yeah, I didn't sacrifice two goats. It was only one, so it's probably not going to be successful.
Right.
Anyway, so
So we,
as we move,
yeah, we have
yes.
about 10 minutes until we wanted to stop this podcast. Do we still want to talk baseball, or was there another sport you wanted to delve into?
Well, if you wanted to delve into something else, be my guest, sir.
I mean, no. I mean, I'm fine talking baseball. We're talking about the day after opening day, but.
Yeah, I mean it should be a national holiday. I was really upset that I wasn't able to take the day off. I was really upset on Sunday night because I was stuck in traffic instead of watching the Cardinals and Cubs,
Yeah.
and the baby Cubs, who I mean got off to a good start. I'm thinking it's a lost season for them. Just keep Chris Bryant down in the minors.
Of course.
I mean they're on pace to go lose all 162 games. I mean, baseball was so worried about him today that they postponed the game.
Of course, yeah, just to give him a little time to recover from that
Yeah.
3-0 drudging.
Yeah, absolute trouncing. I mean, obviously we're kidding. The Cubs will be great. Adam Wainwright just outdueled John Lester. Although from what I heard and some of the highlights I saw, it looked like it was an awful strike zone. Like some of the pitches that were called strike threes, I was like, maybe we need to get some robo umpires in here because these are really really rough calls. But
Yeah, I wish I'd watched a little bit more of it. but I didn't. The one thing I do know that turned out really well for the Cardinals, the one takeaway, was that their new addition, Jason Hayward, looked really good for them.
Yeah, him... sorry, I was going to make a really in poor taste Oscar Tavares joke, so I'm going to delete that, and so we'll go back and...
Can we edit that out?
Yeah, we'll edit that out. So, yeah, I was really... Oh, wait, hold on. Yeah, I was really impressed with Jason Hayward. He contributed well, and I wasn't really surprised in that. He always has been sort of just really solid skill set all around. I thought he was going to do well in that lineup in St. Louis, and so far he's one game in. He's been very, very good for them.
Yeah, Matt Holliday was his usual boring self. Couple of hits, two RBI. Went out there and produced. Matt Carpenter went 2-for-5. And then, you know, they didn't need much else with Adam Wainwright just shutting things down.
Yeah, all in all, a very Cardinals game.
Yeah, very, very unexciting. And yet we're talking about it, Jeff.
Yeah, right? Hey, that's just the Cardinals. They have the same game, like, every game, and somehow people still talk about them because it's a good game. So actually, one thing that I don't think we've talked about, and it isn't baseball anymore. It is a different sport. It is the NFL. Yeah, it is the NFL. Something that we sort of skipped over because we were doing division previews. But what do you think of, in short order, the Niners losing both Patrick Willis and Frank Gore? That they were pretty much the entire franchise for a lot of years. They were the faces of the franchise. Now they both left within the course of a week.
Yeah, I mean, I think most Niners fans had kind of predicted that Frank Gore would be leaving in this offseason, and it wasn't such a major blow because we have a very good, you know, backup running back in Carlos Hyde, and we have some running back depth even behind him. So it didn't seem like such a terrible loss, but certainly a face of the franchise for over a decade now. The one that really stung was the Patrick Willis loss, and what made it sting even more is the fact that it wasn't from injury. It was simply a guy. It was a guy in the middle of his contract, so it was completely unexpected, and it was just a guy who at age 30 decided he didn't want to put himself at risk any further.
Yeah, he was really worried. You know, I think the thing he said is, you know, yes, I could keep playing for a few more years, but who's gonna be playing with my kids, you know, after that? Because I think he was really worried about the toll that it was taking on his body. I know it was a foot thing that got him out last year, and that's been an issue for him for a few years, and he just decided to hang it up.
The thing that really made it sting even more is that the backup plan that was looking pretty good. I mean, I think when people heard it, they didn't take it as bad as it was because they were like, oh, well, at least we've got this super phenom Chris Borland backing him up. And then...
Yeah, that was pretty much my reaction was I was like, well, you know, we did okay without Willis last year. And we're getting Bowman back and we have Borland. And then I saw the Borland retirement thing and I was like, wait, what? He what? Yeah. No, what? And what was funny was when Willis retired, I texted Kate. I was like, because she has a Patrick Willis jersey that she wears to the games. And I was like, oh, Willis retired. I guess it's time to get a Chris Borland jersey. And then Borland retired like less than a week later. And I was like, oh, my God, Kate, you didn't buy a Chris Borland jersey, did you? She's like, no, why? Because like, he's gone, too. She's like, what?
Yeah, and, I mean, you know, it's one of those things that the Willis retirement, while it stung a lot, you could at least kind of understand it because here's a guy that came into the league before the NFL started making a big deal about traumatic brain injury, and he kind of played through his career and got to the point where he was 30 and decided, all right, I don't want anything like that happening or any other physical injury, so I'll get out. But Chris Borland kind of came up through, you know, college and into the league on the pretense that he was putting himself at risk for traumatic brain injury, and then to just cut ties and say, you know, I'm done. It's almost surreal, I think, to anyone who certainly most Giants, certainly most Niner fans, but also maybe just any football fan.
Yeah, I don't blame the guy. I mean, it's his body, it's his life. He can do with it what he wants. I mean, I'm sure you're as level-headed to have that same opinion. People were so mad at him, like on all over the internet. People were saying, you know, if you knew you were going to retire, like, why did the 49ers waste a third-round draft pick on you? People are calling him names. They're calling him a wimp, a loser. I'm like, guys, this guy owes you nothing. You know, it was really sad to see that people who were cheering for Chris Borland, you know, turned on him so fast because he betrayed them somehow, like he owed them something. And, I mean, it sucks to lose a third-round pick, yeah. I mean, I can't dispute that. But, I mean, Chris Borland is going to be one of those things that 49ers fans are going to be talking about for years. He came in, he was incredible.
Right.
And you know, I don't fault the guy at all, and I was embarrassed for 49ers fans because of the way that he was treated, and it was that part just it was very embarrassing for me. And I'm looking at the NFL draft now at who was drafted after him, and I was gonna say there wasn't much after him that got drafted, and there really wasn't except for one guy that I really wanted for the 49ers to draft was drafted 13 picks later, and that was Dante Moncrief. So if we'd gone Moncrief instead of Borland, we obviously wouldn't have gotten Bruce Ellington and Torrey Smith. So it did sort of change the complexion of the franchise, but we'll see how it goes. I do wish Chris Borland, you know, all the best.
You know, the sad reality is that it's exactly that kind of mentality that has contributed to traumatic brain injuries for football players for so many years. You know, like suck it up, and a lot of it's internal, some of it's external, coming from the coaching staff, but a lot of it's and from the league, but a lot of it is internal. You know, these guys go out there and they sacrifice their bodies. And they do it because they don't want to be considered a wimp, or they don't want to be considered as someone who gives up through a little bit of head pain, and it ends up being a problem that ruins the twilight of their lives. So I am in 100% support of a person leaving a game as dangerous as football at any age they decide to. But I did find it somewhat interesting because it's not like traumatic brain injury became an issue this year. It really became an issue a few years back. So it was interesting to me that he would go through college and continue to play and all that stuff, and then get to the NFL and then, you know, light the world on fire and then decide, all right, this is the time I'm leaving.
Yeah, that was a curious decision. And I think what it was I think he matured a little bit, really saw what was going on out there. And I, you know, the Patrick Willis retirement may have done a lot for him to say, you know what, this guy decided to get out. Obviously, Chris Borland, you know, looked up to Patrick Willis before he made it in the league, because every middle linebacker should look up to Patrick Willis. So his decision to retire probably loomed large in Borland's mind and may have sent him over the edge. I saw reports that he was considering retiring, you know, he was considering never entering the NFL draft, and then he got a concussion he played through in practice in the preseason, and then he could start pondering retirement then. And I wonder if Patrick Willis just sort of tipped him over the edge.
Well, you know, good for him. I think a lot of hopefully a lot of level-headed fans and even 49er fans can look at that and say, good for him. Out, Borland decided to leave him. So, I'm happy for him, and I think it's an interesting thing, and it might even become a trend, albeit a scary trend as a fan.
Yeah, that is a scary trend for a fan. Given how many people were, I hear an echo. Do you hear the echo?
I hear an echo coming from you.
That's very strange.
Like in the background of your, yeah.
Maybe then we should cut it off.
We should cut it off.
Because this is going to sound really bad. And it's 6:15.
Really bad. And it's 6:15.
Yes, it's almost 6:15.
So I guess what we'll do is record an ending saying you know, technical issues. We had to cut it off early.
And all right, that. Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, sorry, I've been talking really weird.
I can't hear myself and talk.
I can hear the echo in the background.
Sounds good.
So,
do you want to do two this week, or just stick to once a week?
It's up to you. I can do two a week, or I can do one a week. It's just a matter of when we're gonna release them or how often you want to release them.
Well, I'm gonna release this one tonight.
Okay, good call.
So it's not
going
to matter.
Like a goofy thing.
Do you want to remember to do it?
Sorry, it's my alarm. I mean, if you want to make it a Tuesday, Thursday thing, I'm fine with that. If you want to make it just a Tuesday thing or something. I think we should come up with like a specific day, though, that we do it.
I like Tuesday, Thursday.
Do you like that? I like it, too. It's kind of in the middle of the week, and it gives them something to listen to for hump day and then Friday.
Yeah.
All right, I'm fine with that.
All right, cool. So do you want to get together for Thursday and lead it?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. Sounds good to me.
Let me see. Thursday is the 9th. So I do have a Rivercats game that I'm going to. Let me check the time on that. But we should be able to start like around 5, right? Which shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's just set a tentative time for 5 then.
Okay, cool. Sounds good.
Cool.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right, cool, man.
Talk to you later.
Later.
Bye.